Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, y'all. Welcome back to another episode of the Chase Thomas Podcast, the Friday, June 9th, 2023 edition here on the program. We've got a fun jam-packed show for you guys today. We got Go Big Orange Friday with Ryan Shepherd of Rocky Top Insider and Saturday Down South, Ethan Stone. Good to have the gang back together to talk all things Tennessee Volunteers. Rough week for Tennessee recruiting on the football front. We talk about where they really need to win some key battles to kind of salvage where they're at in recruiting for this cycle, because it's all about the summer now with recruiting. It's not about the fall, winter. It's about the summer. So big summer ahead now for Tennessee's 2024 recruiting class. We also talk about Josiah Jordan James being back for Tennessee. Are they a top five team in the basketball front going into next year? We talk about Olivier Kamwa ending up at Michigan, surprisingly enough. And then Tennessee, how they ended up having to go to Hattiesburg this weekend for their super regional matchup against Southern Miss, and what to expect in that one for Tennessee as they look to get back to the College World Series this season. So fun time this weekend in Knoxville, because that game kicks off in about, like, I don't know, a couple, I shouldn't say a couple, it's like 6 hours, 7 hours from now. So exciting time here on Rocky Top, per usual, here at Everything School HQ. Always something going on with Tennessee athletics on the positive front. Also, we got a first-timer head football coach at Delaware. Yeah, at Delaware, the Blue Hens. Ryan Carty was kind enough to come on the program to talk about his football program, year one at Delaware, what it was like beating Navy, how playing quarterback years ago at Delaware helped him get ready to be an offensive coordinator, offensive mind, and then head coach, where the team is deeper, stronger than they were a year ago, growing up in a family of coaches and how that works and helps things for him. And then Chip Kelly, some accidental advice that stuck with Ryan and helped him as a coach all across the board. So awesome time being able to talk with Coach Carty about his FCS power, the Delaware Blue Hens. So I think you'll love that. So a lot of college football, college sports here on this Friday edition of the program. Don't forget, folks, you can watch this very show, youtube.com/ChaseThomasPodcast. Like and subscribe. Full episodes, shorts, clips, all the good stuff. So make sure you check us out if you are interested in the video front. You can also help the show in one easy, quick way. You could hit that pause button. If you're not already subscribed, go ahead and hit that subscribe button on your preferred podcast player so you never miss an episode. And then if you're already a subscriber and a loyal daily listener here to this National Daily Sports Podcast out of East Tennessee, then first of all, thank you, but also make sure you leave this show a 5-star rating and write a review. Tell why you like the show and help other people find the show because you like it as well. So all that good stuff helps the show continue to grow and all that. So as always, you can email me at chasethomaspodcast@gmail.com. Sign up for our newsletter at sportsrenaissanceman.substack.com. So make sure you check that out as well, if you have not already. And I think that'll just about do it. There you go. Friday edition, Chase Thomas Podcast, coming up in just 1 second. Uncle Darren, let's go.
Chase Thomas Podcast, the Chase Thomas Podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, hello, and welcome back to Go Big Orange Friday. Is it back? Is Ryan Shepherd and Ethan Stone in the same place? Do I not have to just call Ryan Callahan, Austin Price, Brent Hubbs, week over week, just, you know, the legend in this industry. I have to just go with the old heads where I'm just the youngest person on every call here. No, it's time to go back to my roots where I feel extremely old and I feel extremely ancient when I'm talking to either of them in any sort of fashion. Ryan Shumpert, Rocky Top Insider. Good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Doing well. Coming to you live from the Starbucks here in Fountain City. So yeah. Hopefully the Wi-Fi holds up. Hopefully nothing too crazy happens. But busy times with Tennessee going to Super Regional.
There you go. And we'll talk about that, where Ryan gets the pleasure of doing a 14-hour round trip over the weekend to one of America's staples, Hattiesburg, Mississippi. But Ryan, and then you're in Fountain City here. We could just go ahead, because you won't be here after this is up. People aren't going to have to come in. This isn't a live show, so you'll be long gone. But there, I said something to my wife. I don't know if you heard on the broadcast, but Tom Hart said something about Litton's, because I think he mentioned when they were talking about Cal Stark, who went to Farragut, and somehow they were like, I wonder if you went to Litton's a lot. So Litton's made a comment, and I was like, this man, that's like a 45-minute drive from Farragut to Litton's. Like, it was, he wants to mention Litton's, and I appreciate Tom Hart doing the local things, but it was such a stretch where I was like, only Knoxville folks are going to get how insane of a reference this is, where it's like, Cal Stark is not making that drive growing up. Who's doing the Farragut drive to Litton's? That's a long way.
That's a very long way. And no, I did hear that he'd made a Litton's reference. As he usually, when he does, I get a text message about it, but I didn't know it was in context to the Cal Stark, which,
yeah.
I mean, Tom Hart, which obviously makes sense because he makes a Litton's reference all the time. He lived in Knoxville. So he knows.
Yeah.
He knows that trek is not very doable. So he had to be just big time looking for the content to talk about.
I know. I didn't want to put him on blast, but I thought about it and I thought about clipping it and just being like, that is, I'm just going to go ahead and say Cal Stark was not riding to Litton's in Fountain City on a Thursday night. I have my doubts. Also here, Saturday Down South, South Carolina's own Ethan Stone in enemy territory in more ways than one, whether it's Beamer ball, whether it's Dabo ball. The man is gone. He is in another state entirely. Ethan, how are you?
Yeah, I really am in enemy territory here. There's so much Clemson Tigers stuff, whereas my entire life I've had Vols stuff around. You'd be surprised how many Vols fans are here, though. I've run into a couple of them already.
Okay. And
you got to give them the old go Vols when you see them, of course. But there's some pretty decent – I mean, we're only about 3 hours away from Knoxville. But, yeah, getting moved in here. My cat is going to make an appearance. He's – here he comes. He's
there
right
you
here.
Go. What's but, his name again?
Oliver.
Oliver.
Good guy. But yeah, I just getting moved in, getting all situated. We're finally getting pretty close to ready here. We got most of the, I'd say 80% of the house done. So,
there you go.
So we're getting there.
They don't call him Tool Man Ethan Stone for nothing.
Exactly.
It's funny you said the good balls to strangers, because I'll probably never do it again, because I did it to somebody when we were in Asheville a couple months ago. We were doing a pretty good hike up Black Mountain. And there was an older gentleman in a Tennessee polo at the gift shop at where we were at. And I was like, hey, I did a go Vols, and he looked at me and didn't say a word and just kept moving. And I was like, all right, F me then. My bad. Thought we were going to do a whole human connection thing there, but all right. Like, I was wearing a Tennessee like workout shirt, and he was in it. I was like, all right, cool. It was one of the coldest. I looked at my wife and I was like, that was unbearable. We have to leave now. I gotta get out of here. This is terrible. It's not working for me anymore. We gotta run, because that was the last time I'll ever do it. So that's what you get when you let your heart win. And that's also lyrics to another song. Ryan, you texted me, or you put in the group chat, that I have some all-time hater energy over the last week. I was on a heater.
You are
fired up. I've been fired up all week, whether it's Tennessee having to go to Hattiesburg, whether it's Cam Fountain ending up at USC, whether it's Sammy Brown ending up at Clemson, Bryant Wesco landing in Clemson, Boo Carter maybe landing in Michigan sooner rather than later. Ryan, talk me off the ledge. Is the sky not falling? Is it not been Dan Mullen all along here in Knoxville, Tennessee? Did I go to bat for Josh Heupel on the recruiting trail too much And now we're on the verge of multiple number 12 recruiting classes over and over again, where Butch is out here getting top five classes early on in his tenure, at least. Is that where we're at, where I'm just going to have to be okay with 12 and being in the lead for the Francis Maligoas of the world, the Boo Carters of the world, the J.J. Harrells of the world, every single year until it just falls back down to reality and they're at number 12 once again? And it's like, why are we doing this? Why am I doing this to myself? Why am I thinking about a world where Williams Wanneri, Cam Fountain, Cam Franklin, Boo Carter, J.J. Harrell, Mike Matthews are all going to join up with Nico Iamaliava to join a super team? Why am I doing that to myself, Ryan Schumpert? Why?
Okay, so you said one thing that was right, that you did jump the gun on the Josh Heupel recruiting stuff. You're just a prototypical, going back from my days covering baseball at VolQuest, you're just a prototypical general quarters poster. I mean, you were so up and down with the recruiting stuff. It's we're going to get all of them or we're not going to get any of them.
Yes.
And the truth is always somewhere in the middle. And this is, you talk about hater energy. This is big time hater energy for me because I didn't even watch the video. But you and Matt on your podcast this week, and you tweeted out the clip. It was, some extent, will Georgia's linebacker room be fine without Sandy Brown? And I'm like, and this might have been what y'all said. So again, I didn't listen to it. This is pretty uninformed. Yeah, Georgia. I mean, what are we talking about here? Yeah, Georgia's linebacker's room is going to be fine without Sandy Brown. From the Tennessee side of things, Tennessee was never getting Sandy Brown. Him going to Clemson is a huge win for Tennessee. He's not in Georgia. But yeah, I mean, you're right. It's been a tough week for Tennessee football recruiting. But that's the deal. I mean, this is June and July is January and February of old days. There's going to be a million twists and turns. It's incredible to me that you're already punting on Boo Carter before his official visit. Again, this is you riding the wave.
I'm out. He's gone. He's playing wide receiver at Michigan. He's been talked into it. He's not going to play DB at Tennessee. Sky's falling. I'm out.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't want to say that it hasn't been a bad week for Tennessee in the recruiting trail, because it has been, but there's going to be, I think, a lot of twists and turns in the next month and a half. I think Mike Matthews not committing to Clemson this week is a huge win. I think Tennessee is still, my non-expert opinion, the favorite to land him. So to me, Fountain was the one that was really tough. To me, a lot tougher than Harrell, just because defensive line is a premium position, and it felt like Tennessee was in the catbird seat there. But I think Tennessee's going to be fine. I mean, you look at those two spots, and it's been bad this week, receiver and defensive line. I think they're in on a lot of top guys, and you want to doubt Rodney Gardner, go ahead. I'm not going to do it. He's been pulling top guys for 35 years in the Southeast. I think he'll get a couple more of this class.
Okay, I feel better. Ethan Stone, where are you at? Are you in the middle? You're the even-keeled member of this media conglomerate here on the Chase Thomas podcast. Ethan, has it been as bad? Are you okay? Is the Saturday Down South group chat pretty mean in terms of what's happening to Tennessee? Are they enjoying what's going on here? Specifically, Connor O'Gara, Chris Marler, like who? I'm sure Marler has loved this entire week.
This is going to play 100% to what Ryan said. They're not saying anything at all, which okay, is a good thing for Tennessee. I mean, if Tennessee was now like J.J. Harrell flipping, it's not great, but there's a reason for it. It's probably because Mike Matthews might be coming. It's probably because, I don't know about Ryan. I haven't followed the Tennessee football recruiting as closely as I used to in the past, but I know for certain that Mike Matthews has been, you know, kind of predicted to go to Tennessee. Ryan Wingo's in the I guess discussions for it. Amari Jefferson from Chattanooga, also considering Tennessee, just dropped to top six just a little bit ago. So there's still a lot of stuff to go. There's a lot of time, I guess. So I wouldn't hit the panic button right now because of one bad week. And I would agree with Ryan, and I'd agree with you when you guys say that it was not a great week for Tennessee. But that doesn't mean that it's going to, you know, the sky's going to be falling. Every top 5, 6, 7, 10 you see, I mean, 50% of them that I'm writing about at SDS have Tennessee on. I mean, everyone's at the very least considering, and you've got a huge recruiting weekend, I believe on June 23rd coming up with a lot of guys coming too. So I wouldn't quite, just because of one bad week, maybe a bad couple weeks, write off Tennessee completely because a guy's flipping here and there or a guy's picking somewhere else that Tennessee wasn't really even a top prospect for him anyway. So I mean, here in a month, if we're not getting Mike Matthews, those twists and turns, like Ryan's saying, if we're not getting the guys that we're supposed to be getting, that's when I'd start panicking.
Williams Wanneri, Mike Matthews, I need you to get you can me back you can off name the a, ledge.
You can name a baseball team of guys that could still commit to Tennessee in the coming weeks.
That's true. Well, guess what? Even the guys here are deflecting. We have Stanwich out of here. Like, I made the mistake of looking at his Instagram bio and his Instagram page. The dude looks like he was recreated out of a Jordan Beck laboratory. Like him to like
he is a Jordan Beck clone.
Right? Made me sad. And I'm just like, all right, let me back. Okay, 2024, they're number one recruiting there. All right, I'll talk myself off that ledge. They're probably winning the College World Series anyway. So who, it's okay. You can't win literally every year. You can't, there's not enough spots. Everyone can't play here with Tony Vitello's bunch. And look, Ryan, like when you, to be completely realistic here, who do they actually have to land of the remaining big targets to keep Tennessee fans over, like the overwhelming Tennessee fan base, happy with where this class might end up? Who are the big ones that they have to at least land a couple of?
Yeah, I would say, and I think you look at the two spots where they've been heavy on a bunch of guys, I think you got to land like two of Amari Jefferson, Ryan Wingo, and Mike Matthews, and one, you know, at least one of Kamarion Franklin and Williams Nwaeri. And I think it has to probably be kind of combining the two. I think you've got to get one of the five stars in that boat. And where I will agree with you, and we've talked about it on this program before, like I don't worry about receiver recruiting. I don't worry about defensive line recruiting. But the offensive line, like that's what I worry about. And to me, there's less top guys that are in on at that position. And it seems like there's a lot of traction to Daniel Calhoun in Georgia this week. Obviously, the Anderson kid out in Texas is visiting Tennessee this week. He's got connections to Oklahoma. Like, those are guys Tennessee are in on, but maybe not in the catbird seat. And your backup options there, I think, are a lot worse than what you're going to have at receiver and defensive line. So while you're talking about the common fan, what's going to keep them off the ledge, I think it's probably more the defensive line and the receivers that I mentioned. But when I look at it, like, I just think they're going to be fine at those two spots. And I think they're going to get enough of those guys. I'm more worried and have my eyes more set on the offensive line just because that's an area that they haven't been great recruiting. And as good as Glenn Ellerbe has been on an on-field coach, I would say he's probably been the weak spot of the staff on the recruiting trail. And, you know, as you've said before on this podcast, Darnell Wright's gone. The five stars you inherited are gone. You got to start bringing some of those guys in. And they really haven't done that at this point. They brought in some good guys, but they haven't recruited at an elite level. And there's some good prospects they're in on, but not enough elite guys to where those other positions you feel like you're just naturally going to get some, how the numbers work out. So that's kind of the spot that fans probably aren't paying quite as close attention to, but I'm going to have my eye on over the next 6 weeks.
Yeah, you look at like Gage Ginther. Yeah, it's great. He might rise up to four-star whatever by the time the season ends. But it's like that's still a long-term project. Like all these guys you look at and you're like, all right, I mean, maybe. But those guys, generally speaking, I don't think you're going to be able to turn all of these three-star offensive tackle and inside linemen into premier SEC talents. Like there is still a reason. Like Darnell played better with Ellerbe than he did with Pruitt, and he developed better under Glenn Ellerbe. But like it still required he had that five-star talent out of the gate here that was just there. It was evident, and you're able to work with that. Like Cooper's gone. I think there is actually another Mays brother, though, isn't there? Isn't there one more?
I think he's way younger.
Okay.
Like probably in middle school right now.
No. Well, we got a ways to go until the next the Mays brother comes up. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like when we talk about this year, like we still feel pretty okay by and large with where the line's going to be. It's not going to be devastating. I think the tackle spots might be potentially bad. But outside of that, next year, I mean, Campbell's gone. I don't think both tackle spots are probably going to be different. At least one right guard spot's different, and then the center's position's different. Like it's going to be a very different offensive line next year, and that's when you're like, okay, well, LB's had 3 years, and they're going to have to dip a bunch in the portal again. Like I just don't see a way where they don't remake their offensive line in the portal, and I wonder if that's what they end up doing because they're not landing those bigger names. Is they're just going to have to swing big in the portal and utilize NIL in the portal with transfers. Like that's just where their transfer targets line up year over year. It's just they're not getting the high school 4 or 5 stars. They're going to have to get them in the portal and bank on them working out and being a plug and play option in Knoxville. That's where it seems like we're headed on that front. Do you agree?
Yeah, in the immediate future, like talking about next year, I think you're absolutely right. And especially at tackle. I think you look and there's, again, I've said this on here before, to me, and I don't want to undersell it, but to a lot of, in the recruiting process, guards a lot of time to me are kind of a dime a dozen. Like you can find a lot of good interior offensive linemen, big strong dudes. Jamontez Spraggins to me is the great example of that. Super, super low time recruits, low rated 3-star, and he's been great for Tennessee. He's got that nasty streak in him. And he's a really good player. And, you know, they have some guys like that. Ashton Nichols is obviously was a little bit of a bigger recruit, but a guy I think is going to be really good. Heck, might even end up starting for him this year at guard.
Yeah.
Definitely in 2 years is going to. So I think there they probably have enough in the interior to piece it together. But to your point, like, it's hard to look at the young guys they have on this roster and be like, yeah, there's a lot of offensive tackles you feel good about who can step into that. Doesn't mean no one will. No one will develop, but it does seem like they're probably going to have to it's trending towards that direction, like you said, of having to pick up some guys out of the portal.
And then Alec Ablin, I'm curious to see. He's got like he was thrown to the fire with some of these guys. He's going to have to start landing somebody. Like, you look at the tight end room going into next year. I mean, it's just Ethan Davis right now is all we're looking at here. So what he has to do on the recruiting trail this year and in the transfer portal over the next year is going to be huge. There is a lot of pressure on Alec Ablin to build depth and get some big fish to replenish this tight end room.
Definitely. And, you know, one thing I would say with him that, and obviously lost Riddell to Georgia and LeBlanc, the kid down at Baylor to Ohio State, and, you know, not to say those weren't tough losses, but I think it's easy to overlook, and this could come back and backfire. He could decommit that I say this, but Jonathan Echols, when Alex Golish left, all the buzz that I heard was that he was, you know, if he wasn't going to decommit, he was going to go on a bunch of visits, and that was very much an open recruitment. To this point, it seems like he's still relatively steady at Tennessee. Obviously, he's still committed, so that's one that Alec Ablin won't get any credit for because he didn't land them. But if Jonathan Echols ends up signing with Tennessee, I think Alec Ablin deserves a ton of credit for that. And you're right, they need to find a second or third guy to pair with him. But don't overlook Ablin's importance and if Tennessee holds on to Echols and how pivotal he was to do that.
There we go. Ethan, is Tennessee a top five roster with Josiah Jordan James back? Do you feel comfortable with that preseason top five ranking?
The best shooter
on the team, by the way.
This is such a tough question because I know Ryan and I disagree on this, but if you look at it from, I mean, once again, I look at things from a national perspective more than I do from a Tennessee or a simple roster perspective. If you look at this team from a national perspective and you don't think they're at the very least a top seven, I really looked into it. I think they're top five, at the very least top seven. I mean, they have everyone in their starting five is, well, their projected starting five is returners and Dalton Kennett, which, you know, it's hard to put too much into transfers, but I think he's going to be a daggum good one. I think Kennett is going to be really good. And Tennessee's roster, just in general, it's returning veterans. It's good newcomers. It's good people from the transfer portal. And by good people from the transfer portal, I mean Ledlam and Kennett, because they're probably the two that are actually going to do something in the court this year. But you've just got so many different avenues for Tennessee to be good that I think you can you can put them in that conversation and not be ridiculed for it. Jeff Borzello agrees with me. Jeff Borzello has them as a top five team right now. And that's going to change because there's going to be people, you know, moving around a little bit. I feel like May 31st was kind of the deadline for a lot of that action. Sorry, my dog is going crazy. But like, for example, when Ryan and I were talking about it, Zach Edey, in that time, Zach Edey has come back at Purdue. So, you know, Purdue, I'm not sure. People are championing Purdue as a top five team in the country. I personally don't see it. I just don't. It's just because Zach Edey is coming back. That's why people are going to say Purdue is that good. But, I mean, otherwise you got Kansas, Michigan State, and Duke that you can definitely put above Tennessee right now. Marquette, maybe. Kentucky's potential, not them right now because there's too many
friends.
Yeah, I would
put them ahead of Tennessee.
Not right now, but their potential to be maybe. USC's potential to be maybe. But you can't put them ahead of Tennessee right now. Like, you can't say definitively that they're top five preseason teams. Tennessee, however, because they have all these veterans, because they have new guys coming in, because they have solid pieces in the transfer portal, their only real question to me is post. But you got Tobe, you got Jonas, you got, I mean, you know, that's the question mark, is whether or not you have enough guys in the post, probably running Josiah at the four, that could get you to that top five level. Me personally, I think calling him top five is not a crazy thing at all. Now, if you look more at the roster and you say, is this a top five roster? Kind of like Ryan was arguing with me on about a week ago on this. I would tend to agree with Ryan because you got a lot of questions. You got Zakai, who is not healthy yet, not 100%. I expect him to be healthy, but, you know, your starting point guard not healthy going into the season, that's not great. You got a lot of transfers that you have to rely on. You're going to have to rely on at least one of these freshmen between Estrella, Carr. I'm going to count Dillion as a freshman because this is going to be his first season. You got to count on at least one of them to do something of any merit. And that's a lot of things to ask of a basketball team for a top five team. I will definitely yield that. But if you look at their overall what they're returning, I definitely think they're a top five preseason team.
What about you, Ryan? Have you, after a week of thinking about Ethan just destroying us in the Twitter DMs,
I understand. I'm not 100% like, you know, they are definitely like, I wouldn't hate you for not saying it, but I'm fired up, man.
You're ready to go.
I think they're going to be daggum good. I think a lot of people are underestimating them. I think they're going to be really good.
Punch the final four tickets, says Ethan.
Anyway,
Stone,
I'm going to shut up now.
What about you, Ryan? Are you there?
I think I'm not there. I think Ethan did a good job of explaining the difference of how we look at it, where to me, yeah, preseason, like, sure, you just want to look at like the roster, what's proven. You know, there probably is a good case that they're top five, but preseason rankings in college basketball, hardest of any sport. Nobody besides Aaron Torres, who went to UConn, had UConn in their preseason top 25 last year. Not a soul had Kansas State close to threatening. It's just so hard with how these rosters change year in, year out to project things. So I look at it less of compared to everybody else and more, all right, what does Tennessee have pieces wise? And if you're asking me, do I think at some point next season will Tennessee be in the top five? We'll say even after November, so we take out the preseason element of it. I would probably say yes. I mean, they were last year. But when I look at, has this team done enough to address their issues and be they're going to be in top five from start to finish of the year, the vast majority of the season? I don't have that as a definitive yes. I don't think it's necessarily a no. I mean, I think Dalton Knecht is a really talented guy and could be a star, but it's hard for me to say you're going from playing Northern Colorado. I couldn't even tell you what conference you were. That's in a bad Northern Colorado team, I'll add. Not a good Northern Colorado team. He's shooting as much as he wants. It's hard for me to say that that's going to be an easy transition, especially with Rick Barnes' kind of history at Tennessee with transfers. And not many of them have panned out. And even more than that, I think that's where the most of the talk will be. I think Freddie DeLeon is a big X factor just because his ability to score. But you look at it, and this is what I said last week. Santiago Vescovu, I'm a huge fan of. I think he's a great player. Is still the best scorer on Tennessee's team. And you could say Zakai Ziegler is a close second. Besides that, there's not really a close second. And that's Tennessee's issue, is finding consistent scoring game in, game out. And I just don't know that they have definitive answers to that. Dalton Knecht could be that. I'm certainly super high on Jemai Meshack. I think he's capable of taking a step forward and probably not being a number one guy, but being a better number two or three than Tennessee had last year. And I think you could say the same thing, probably only with Awaka offensively, that he could take a step and be a double-digit scorer. But you don't know. You're projecting guys taking jumps forward, which are certainly possible. And then you're looking at a guy like Knecht, or you're looking at a guy like DeLeon, who hasn't proven it at this level. They're definitely really talented scorers. But what happens when you get in the heart of the season? What happens when Rick Barnes is on you about your defense not being good enough? Do you keep that confidence offensively? And are you able to push through and kind of become get into a groove offensively playing with the depth Tennessee's going to have? You know, these guys, it's no guarantee any of them are going to get 20 minutes a game. Can they get into a rhythm and become consistent offensive threats? That's what I don't really know about. I think this team's floor is really, really high, and that's where I'll give Rick Barnes and the staff a ton of credit for what they did this offseason. This is a team that I think will spend the entire year in the top 25. But when you're talking about top five team that is one of the best in the country, they could get there. I'm not saying they can't, but to me, there's still a lot of questions to be answered.
I just wonder who it's probably going to change throughout the year. And obviously when Zakai is ready, and then injuries are always just a part of it. But I do wonder who will end up being the best five. I wonder if there's going to be like friend of the pod, Will Warren, and I wonder if there's going to be like a disconnect between like, clearly this is the best five for Tennessee and what Barnes is going to want to do for his best five. I wonder if there's going to be a disconnect this season, because there is a lot of potential for Barnes going super big here and relying on going super big and trusting that more than the versatility he might have with Zakai, DeLeon, Josiah Jordan James, Dalton Connect, and Jonas Idu or something like that. Like, I wonder what the best five and should be the closing five will end up being for Tennessee, and if it will result in some hurt feelings. Because I wonder what Ludlum has been told coming into the process, because I don't see a way he should be on the court in important moments late in games. Like, if there is a point where it's like Adu and Ludlum, I'm going to be upset. I'm going to be annoyed, because if you want to start there, that's fine. Like, you want to start games big and just brutalize people on the boards, like, that's fine. But I just don't see a scenario where those two should be on the floor to close. Maybe Ludlum's the closing five and Adu gets his feelings hurt and he's not the closing five. I don't know. I have my doubts, and I'm pretty high on Adu coming in this year. I'm very curious, because I think he actually could be a pretty solid wide open three pick and pop shooter. Like, you see it in practice and like corner and top of the key three. I think it can happen if he trusts it. Like, he is someone, Adu has the most upside of any of them to me and what he can do, but we'll see if he ends up being that closing five. I don't know, Ethan, do you agree with that? And what do you see the best five being?
That Adu, the three, that's interesting. I mean, that's more projecting, like Ryan is talking about. That's more, you know, hoping he can get to that point where, I mean, there was a point where Olivier couldn't shoot either.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll get to Olivier, I'm sure. But well, there was a point where he couldn't shoot beyond the arc either. He developed that and he became a legitimate threat at that. It's so difficult to project that kind of stuff, because there's a couple guys that are question marks like that. You got Ledlam, who is I agree with you, Chase. I don't know what Ledlam's going to do from here out. Especially, I'm assuming he assumed that James was not coming back,
right? And
he's the one that gets the short end of the stick to be with Josiah coming back. Like, he's the one that's got to be like, this is a very tough break for a guy that had a lot of good options.
Yeah. And I think Ledlam has the potential to be pretty decent. It's a jump from the Ivy League to the SEC. So that's always going to be something you have to take into account. I think he'll be like an eight maybe on this team, maybe an eight or a nine on the team at best now with Josiah coming back. The other question mark for me is Estrella, because you talk about, now I don't think he's going to be a big Grant Williams year one or anything like that by any means. I don't think he's going to be dominant by any means right off the bat. I do think, especially with, depending on how Barnes wants to go about this, like you said, Chase, whether or not he wants to go traditional or whether or not he wants to run Josiah at the four and just keep going small, Estrella could be an interesting option to back up Adu, just to see. I mean, if he's good, that's probably something they're going to run. They're going to run a lot of Adu, Estrella, and then, I don't know, maybe Tobe. It's difficult to say that, because there's a million guys on this roster that can do a million different things. So it's kind of hard to project where all of them are going to go. I don't think he's incredibly important. I just think Estrella is someone going to be interested in. If he's really good, I think that is really, really good for Tennessee. If he's not really good, I don't think it's going to hurt him by any means. But, you know, as far as projected lineup, I mean, assuming Zakai is healthy, you get Zakai, Santi, probably Connect, Josiah, and Adu would be my guess for a starting five at the start of the season. Now, where are they going to go with that? I have no idea. There's a million different roster combinations that you can move on from there. Another question I have is, will Jordan Ganey see the court literally ever? like literally
ever. I saw him on campus today.
Is he ever going to see the court? That's very interesting to me, because I don't know. I feel like he was an incredibly good shooter. The problem is he's at a smaller conference. He's a little undersized, and he doesn't really fit ahead of anybody. Like, he's not going to play ahead of Viscovi. He's not going to play. I don't think he's going to play ahead of DeLeon, honestly. He's not going to go ahead of Zakai, obviously. So where's he going to fit in as a rotational player? With all the guys in front of him, is he going to play a Tyreek Gee role? Is he never going to see the court at all? I'm leaning more towards the latter, that he's just never going to see the court at all. So it's, you have
how many years of eligibility does he have? Does he really need to this year, or will he? I don't know. I
mean, he has 2 years of eligibility. He could redshirt possibly too, because he hasn't redshirted yet.
That would probably be the best move, honestly, because I don't see any way for him, especially if we're going to talk Ledlam. I don't see any way for him to see the court personally.
I wonder
that projected five, though, that would be mine. The Zakai, Santi,
I'll say before the year, or before Sakai comes in, because I don't think he's ready, right, like opening night. I would be surprised if he's in the starting lineup opening night. I would probably guess it's Santi, Freddie, Meshack, Ledlam, Adu. Would you agree with that, Ryan, or do you think it's different?
I would say to start the year, if Sakai is not out there, I think it's Santi, Jamai, either Freddie or Josiah, and then I think they're going to start the year, Tobe and Jonas starting.
That's oh, just really?
Knowing would... Rick Barnes, like that just, I think he's going to start the year big. Now, yeah. If you want to talk about to me what's like, what's the best case scenario for Tennessee's lineup? Like things pan out, what's Tennessee's starting lineup? To me, it's Sakai, it's Santi, it's Jamai, it's Connect, and it's Adu, and then you got Freddie coming off the benches that scored. It can kind of spark some things. But what I would say with all of this, and maybe this won't be starting, but you talk about closing time, I think this goes back to what my concern and why I can't say this is a top five team yet, is I just think until you see consistency with a lot of these guys, when they have nine, I mean, Barnes is going to have 9 or 10 guys to play, and we know how he likes to use the bench as a motivator. Like I just think you're going to see the closing time lineup from December through February change a lot. And you're just not going to have, if you don't have consistency from Meshack, or you don't have consistency from any of the transfers or the big men, like those guys don't take jumps forward. Like, I just think you're going to see Barnes lean on the depth and lean on his ability to use the bench as a motivator and use defense as kind of, or being able to use the benches, like to hold guys hostage to playing really hard defense. And until I see Rick Barnes prioritize offense at any point over defense, that's just going to be my mindset of what I think he's going to do.
I hadn't really thought about that before. That's a good – I mean, it's very similar to what he did this past season, really. I mean, having too many guys can definitely be a negative. I mean, because you're not allowing guys to get into a groove moving into the more important parts of the season. I think
someone's going to get buried. Maybe two to three people are going to get buried.
That's a really good point.
100%.
But it's a good problem to have. Like, iron sharpens iron. Like, it's good to have this kind of depth where you're not just having, like, we're out of guys. Like, we don't really have another option here. Like, there's going to be some good players who are buried on the bench when Tennessee gets rolling. And I'm just very curious to see who ends up being those guys. Olivier Kamwa, though, ends up at Michigan. A lot of folks thought he was going to end up overseas, if anywhere. Kind of surprising. Michigan, I don't think, is going to be very good next year. So it's probably, I don't know if that's better for him, that he's going to have more opportunities to do a lot more, kind of replacing that Hunter Dickinson role for the Wolverines. But I don't know, Ethan, do you like the fit for Olivier at Michigan, or do you think this is probably not going to go well in his final year of college basketball?
Michigan was like spot number one for him, if not overseas, at the very beginning of his recruitment. And then they kind of died off, and it was Baylor and West Virginia. And then Michigan out of nowhere, like a week ago. I guess he had an official visit there or something. Michigan came out of nowhere and was back in contention, and then he was committed like the next day. So I think that has something more over to do with starting and playing time, because I don't think at West Virginia and Baylor he was going to – I mean, he was probably going to come off the bench slash be the fifth guy that started on the floor. And it's – I mean, you're going to have a Michigan post-Hunter Dickinson, and you're going to have – I don't know everything about their roster, but I know they lost a lot, and I know they're probably not going to be fantastic. Can't quote me on that because I just don't really know what they have around him. I haven't looked that much into Michigan lately. But, I mean, it's if he can't get his original goal of going and, I don't know, playing overseas or playing just a professional career in general, it's not a bad place for him because, I mean, he's run out of time in college. You want to start. You don't want to go back and do the same thing you would have done at Tennessee, or take a step back from what you would have done at Tennessee. I mean, he was starting this past season, so you don't want to go to West Virginia and all of a sudden be, you know, the sixth man at a Big 12 school where the schedule is considerably harder than it is in the SEC. So it's a good place for him. As far as do I know if it's going to be a perfect fit for him, or if he's going to light the world on fire, or if he's going to falter out, I really couldn't tell you because I just don't know much about Michigan's roster and what they're doing at the moment.
Ryan, what do you think? What's your gut tell you? Does he ultimately work out at Michigan or no?
My gut tells me he'll be at Michigan a lot like he was at Tennessee. Some really good games, a lot of inconsistencies, never fully put it together. So that's my thought. Again, I don't have the expert opinion on what his fit's like at Michigan. But what I will say about the Olivier Kamwa transfer portal process, and I'm taking off, that's why I like coming on the podcast, I'm taking off my Big J hat here. This is not inside information. This is what I speculation, but past speculation. I think this is pretty well-informed speculation. Not maybe not well-informed, but accurate. What he did really well is the way, my understanding, I think Barnes said something like it in the press conference, is that when he entered the portal originally, the plan was to go play overseas, but his dad wanted him to enter the portal. And then he just laid low for about a month. Laid low, went on, I guess, a couple visits, didn't make any decision, and he let everybody in the transfer portal, just about everybody, make their decision. And then he sat back there and waited, and he waited, and he waited, and teams got desperate. And I think he got a bag because of it, to be frank with you. I think he significantly increased, again, that's all speculation, I think he significantly increased his NIL opportunities by waiting and waiting for teams to get a little desperate, or teams that needed pieces and were willing to spend a little over what his production probably will be. And I think you saw the perfect example of this was, I guess, I don't know, all the days are running together with baseball, but earlier this week, after his Michigan visit, all the On3 people and Trilly Donovan and Andrew Slater, all the Twitter experts on college basketball recruiting, Olivier Kamwa's down to two schools, West Virginia and Baylor. A day later, Michigan's back in the hunt. A day later, he commits to Michigan. I'm no genius. I'm not a world-renowned educated person, but those feel like pretty easy dots to connect, and a pretty darn good job by Olivier Kamwa and his family of playing the game and maximizing his potential.
I wish him nothing but the best, but I love that theory that he got the bag and that it actually worked out, because the general consensus is like, you want to get in the boat, you want to make a commitment early before time runs out and spots are filled and everything else. But actually waiting for a Caleb Love to not come through Michigan and just kind of buying your time and seeing which big program, big blue blood, gets desperate enough, and you just kind of slide right in. So that, if that is indeed what happened, good for him.
And it's hard to get good men in Portland. Like, there just aren't that many of them. And Olivier was always good enough of a player that even if it didn't work out, and you know, people filled the roster and he wasn't going to be able to get a bag somewhere, like, he was never going to get left off of having a Power 5 option. And that's on top of the fact that he could have gone and played overseas. So, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
There you go. We'll wrap up with the Tennessee Vols baseball team. Ryan, you're pretty plugged in here. When you saw that Tennessee was not hosting over the weekend in the Super Regionals against the Southern Miss Golden Eagles, what was your immediate thought, and what can you speak to when it comes to why Tennessee is not hosting?
Yeah, so I mean, when the announcement came out Tuesday, I wasn't surprised. Just from talking to some people around the program on Monday, there was not, you know, no one said there's no chance, but there was not a lot of optimism that they were going to host. They thought they were going to have to go on the road. So that's kind of how I thought about it. I was obviously very depressed. Southern Mississippi in the middle of June, 7 hours. I mean, it's an act of terrorism from the NCAA to do it to me. So as to why, you know, I think there's really two things you can point to here. I think the first one, and, you know, they list their main parameters being like being able to host, having a stadium and hotel rooms, and all both teams could do that. Mm. About 1,000 more seats at Pete Taylor Field. I think they wanted the money of being able to sell 2,000, 3,000 more tickets over the course of 3 days. And I do think there was a little bit of politics that went into it as well, where there's some connections on the selection committee to the Southern Miss program. And I'm going blank on their coach's name right now, but obviously he's in his last season. I don't necessarily think Tony Vitello is the most well-liked guy across the college baseball spectrum. Real hot take from me there. but I think those sort of things that kind of went into it, because when you look at resume, certainly there wasn't some massive divide between the two teams, but anything you look at, Tennessee had the better resume. I mean, every category besides wins, when Southern Miss had, I think, four or five more wins playing in the Sun Belt. So RPI, which has been the king for every decision they've made, shrink the schedule, more impressive regional win, more quality wins. Tennessee's got all of it. So I think it went to the money for being able to sell more tickets, and then maybe a little bit of politics mixed in there as well.
Yeah, I don't like it, but I wonder, do you think it's something that Tennessee it's going to end up being a positive, Ethan, that they have to go on the road, that they can play kind of ticked off because of what just happened, and they thought they were going to be able to host, and they look at it as they are the better team by just about every metric, that they are a better baseball team than Southern Miss at this point in time. Like, is that, can you spin it for a positive that it's actually good that Tennessee will not take Southern Miss lightly because they have to travel and they're going to just play ticked off all weekend?
It can be spun as a positive. It's definitely not a positive. I mean, especially, you know, you'll want, I get what you're saying. It can definitely be spun as a positive. But, I mean, if you want to play the black jerseys thing and the if you look good, you feel good thing, if you want to play the Tony can say you guys were disrespected and all that, even though Ryan's 100% correct that it's just because of money. And that's, I mean, that's how the world's been. It's what keeps things going is money. Every single decision is going to be made by money. And I feel like that's, I mean, Tennessee versus Southern Miss. Anyone in their right mind, if they weren't even talking about baseball, would pick Tennessee in that aspect. You can definitely spin it into a positive, though. I mean, Tennessee has played better on the road as of extremely late. They did not play well during the season on the road, but they went and they beat South Carolina on the road to end the season. They just outlasted a really tough regional in Clemson, which is obviously on the road. And, you know, there's nothing showing that they're going to revert back to midseason balls and just all of a sudden be terrible. But then again, that's what you said last year against Notre Dame. not necessarily the road balls, but just that they'll overlook them, I guess, is also a possibility that Southern Miss is the team that's not as difficult as Clemson. And for Tennessee to revert back to their midseason form would be very Tennessee. But I don't necessarily think it's a good or bad thing. I think there's ways that Tony Vitello can amp up his team to still be able to beat what is, by all metrics, as we've already discussed, an inferior team as of right now, as of how they're playing right now. Especially Tennessee has played really good baseball. They just knocked off a team that won, I think, 17 in a row in Clemson. And, I mean, they were going to do it again, very likely, if Charlotte hadn't beaten them because they're tired. And so Tennessee's playing great baseball right now. Southern Miss is also playing great baseball right now, but I don't necessarily think it being in Hattiesburg is going to be the impending doom for Tennessee, I guess, if that's your question.
3 o'clock on Friday. I'm just going to be, well, I guess it'd be 2 o'clock local time. I'm going to be smashing two vitamin waters together, Stone Cold style, and just getting ready to go for this because I want to just throttle. I was so annoyed, and I told my wife, I'm like sweating how annoyed that I'm not going to be able to go to a super regional at home this weekend. Like, I am so annoyed that I need it to be embarrassing. I want it to be full on Jordan Beck flicking off the outfield as he's rounding the bases. I want this to be the old time FU to the NCAA. And unfortunately, Southern Miss is going to have to take the beating here for hosting in this regard. Ryan, I just, because I'm not a capital J journalist when it comes to Tennessee, I can do this. You can't, but in spirit, I hope that you feel the same for having to make this 14-hour round trip over the weekend, because I just hope it's a bloodbath. I really do. I hope they just absolutely throttle Southern Miss in two games.
Well, the thought of it being two games and only having to spend one night in Hattiesburg is an unbelievable win. Mm-hmm. And that's honestly my prediction. Like, it's baseball, so I wouldn't be shocked if things go otherwise, but Tennessee is just playing really well right now, and everything they struggled with all last season, or not all last season, all this season, regular season, they did so well in the Clemson region. I mean, the defense was fantastic. There were games where they did not hit well early, and they stuck with it, and they were able to grind out some runs and stay in the game against Clemson, and then in the Charlotte game three, they didn't come out firing, but they stuck with it. And then the crazy one, you know, Tony Vitello pitching decision has not gone Tennessee's way this season, and by goodness, with Chase Burns, I thought he made 6 different mistakes. He joked afterwards at his own dad. So the first thing he said to him was, boy, would I have managed that game differently. But the decisions worked out. So all those things that Tennessee struggled with seem to have gone well for them. And Southern Miss is certainly a good team. I don't want to say they're not, but I think Tennessee's more talented. I think the depth and number of arms Tennessee's going to be able to throw at Southern Miss is going to be unlike anything they've seen all season. And you look at Tanner Hall, who's really the star of that Southern Miss team on the mound. Threw 151 pitches last weekend. I'm sure he'll be good. I'm sure he'll be able to throw a good outing. But that's a lot to turn around and be really effective in that type of workload in the weekend and then go do it again the second weekend. Kevin Copps is the only guy I've ever seen do it. So maybe Tanner Hull has got that Kevin Copps in him. But
against an SEC program of all things, too. I mean, they've only played a couple Power 5 programs. Am I wrong?
Yeah, no, that's correct. They dropped 2 out of 3 to Illinois in the regular season. They lost midweeks to Alabama and the Mississippi schools. And obviously, they beat Auburn last week in that regional. So they haven't been fantastic there. I don't, you know, buy too much into that just because those midweek games are kind of wonky with who you're pitching. But yeah, they haven't been haven't had a ton of experience there. And then the other last thing I'd say, you know, they use about 7 arms pretty heavily. Only 2 of those guys are lefties, and they're kind of down the list. So obviously, Tennessee got the kitchen sink of lefties thrown at them last week at Clemson. They'll get a little bit easier task against right-handed pitching this weekend.
There you go. Ethan Stone, what can the good folks check out from you and the team over at Saturday Down South this week?
Yes, the Supers kick off. We'll have full coverage of all the Big Four, ACC, Pac-12, Big Ten, and SEC. Those are the sites that we cover. So any of those teams in the Supers, we'll be covering them. Also covering the Women's College World Series, Florida State and Oklahoma. Florida State has no chance. Oklahoma is generational, absolute juggernaut. Wish Tennessee could have gotten there. That would have been fun, but we've been covering that all weekend, and we'll continue to moving into the future.
There you go. Ryan Schumper, what about you and the team over at Rocky Top Insider this week?
Yeah, so Jack Foster and I will be down in Hattiesburg, so we'll have tons of coverage from that. I have a feature story coming out on Friday about Camden Sewell and, you know, some of the adversity he's gone through this year and just what he's meant to Tennessee's program. So plenty of stuff on that. Full steam baseball. Rick will be back in Knoxville holding down the fort for any football or basketball news that comes up. So as always, everything covered. And yeah, Ethan kind of let it in there, but shout out to Lady Vols, the softball. Fantastic season. Heck of a run. And like I said, wish it could have lasted a little bit longer, but good as Oklahoma is, I think it would have been pretty unlikely it ended holding the trophy.
No one's beaten the Sooners. So third place is nothing to hang your head on.
No, not at all.
You might say nobody's beaten Oklahoma soon. Brian Schumpert, Ethan Stone, thank you as always. And I'll talk to y'all very soon. All right, we're back here on the Chase Thomas podcast, taping this with a first timer here. He is the head football coach for the Delaware Blue Hens, one of my favorite all-time college football uniforms. Like, it's just really hard to beat the Delaware Blue Hens look and logo and helmet and just all around FCS field. Ryan Carty is here. Ryan, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I'm doing awesome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. What have you had any time to get away this summer? Are you going on vacation? Have you what do you do in Delaware? What's your favorite like getaway type of deal?
Well, that's a good question. Around here, the Delaware beaches are pretty Northeast renowned for sure. I grew up in Jersey, so I did grow up with an affinity to the Jersey Shore as well. And so the East Coast up here is this is the kind of time you want to be spending on the Northeast Coast. Gets a little colder as the year goes on, and in August it's pretty hot. So we get a chance to get away a little bit here and there. June and July have become, you know, it's a little bit more of a breather months than the rest of the year, but they've kind of, with the changing in college football and the landscape, pretty much doesn't stop anymore, which is what it is. It's not a complaint. It's just, you know, kind of where we live in now. And so, we'll get, my wife will divorce me if we don't go somewhere at some point. And so we'll plan that probably right before training camp starts. We'll have a chance where the student athletes are, you know, get a chance to go home. And our assistant coaches have a decent summer, and so there'll be some time in there that we can steal, that I'll be forced to steal for ourselves. How about you?
For me, we just did Asheville. We might actually be going up the coast, flying into Boston in a couple weeks and driving up because my father-in-law is actually from Maine, so might be doing that this summer and driving up, because I mean I've heard, and I'm sure you're very well in tune with just the beauty of just spring, summer, and fall up the coast, and see a lot of cool spots. So that's actually in the cards this summer.
That sounds cool.
Yeah. And I think we're both like, I'm a naturally pretty fair skinned guy. You're naturally fair skinned guy. Are you SPF 50? How high do you go for summer football and summer beach stuff?
In training camp, I'll be at least 30.
Okay.
Usually in that 30, 45, 50 range.
Yeah.
I just honestly try to stay out of the sun too.
Yeah. The sun doesn't win. Isn't it one of the, there's a great comedian bit who was just like, the idea that you have to be macho about the sun where you're like, I can take the sun and it's just the sun. And you're like, you think you can beat the sun? Is that what you think? What are you doing? You're losing that battle every day of the week. It's not worth it. Coach, I want to first ask you, like, what is the biggest thing you learned about yourself as a head coach in year one at Delaware?
That's a great question. I think I learned a decent amount of things about myself as a head coach. I think there were certainly things. It wasn't something that I always really wanted to do. It wasn't like that was my end goal in football. I love coaching student athletes. I love getting the most out of people. I really enjoy offensive football. I love calling plays. And I think my initial goals in my career were to call plays. And I really, I got a chance to do it at a really high level and I enjoyed it. And so it wasn't like I was looking for that next head coaching job. And so when I got this and went this direction, I was a little unsure of what, my first steps were going to be and how good I was going to be at certain things. I think the thing I learned about the process and about the position and about myself in it is that the people I've worked with, and I knew that I had worked for some great head coaches, but the people I had been around had prepared me for a lot of situations that I was about to step into that I didn't necessarily know specifically what those situations were going to be. But when they arose, I was glad that I had been mentored by some really good football coaches and been around some really good people. And I think the other thing that I noticed is that, as we as things happen, as they're going to in any job, is being able to rely on people that you've hired, I think is something that, when coming up as even as a coordinator and when you're managing people, there are more things that you can just do on your own and even say, don't worry about it, I'll just take care of it, because there's enough hours in the day. Whereas if you're also, you're still doing that coordinator thing and now you're trying to be a head coach, there's less hours in the day for that. And so you really have to rely on, whether it be the offensive piece, I have to rely on the people that I have hired to help me out there, and delegating things in the support roles, and really believing in the people that you've brought in the program, and you brought them in for the right reasons. And so I think that that's something I've learned. Certainly how to do faster here because of out of necessity, really having to delegate and trust and believe that we've got the right people, and then grow and develop those people into those roles. If maybe they're not ready yet, making sure that they are ready by the time the next problem arises.
I like it. The college football fan world all collectively were tuned in for Delaware Navy this past year, Ryan. I will say my dad is a retired Marine, a lot of Navy. I'm named after a Navy midshipman from way back in the day. But it was one of those things where everyone's like, wait, Delaware's going to do this. And we're all tuned in. What was it like beating Navy this year? And what was it like going in? Did you have a pretty good feel? Because I talked to a lot of coaches and it feels like by Thursday when you run through the tape and you really start seeing stuff, you're like, I feel like I have a pretty good feel for how this is going to go. Did you have a pretty good feel by Thursday, Friday?
I did not. I'm going to be honest with you. That was one of those games in particular, not knowing what they were really going to be doing on defense, knowing that the cut block rules had changed on offense, how much that was going to change what they did on offense, and not knowing anything really about our team. Because again, we were first year coaches. And so, we understood what they did in spring ball and we understood who they were in fall camp, but until you see them in live action, you don't know what, those guys on the field are going to perform like and what happens when the chips are down and, how much are we, influencing them as coaches as we get going. And so I was very, I would say still unsure going into that game, what we were going to see from either side. What I was most proud of was just how hard we played. I mean, that was one of the one thing that came through in that game was that there was there was no back down, there was no give up. And, you know, even when things weren't going right, you know, we stayed together and we played really hard. And so it was pretty special to have that, you know, be one of the first things that I can point back to and say that was one of the first things that we did in this program. And pretty special.
There you go. Where is your team deeper and stronger than where they were a year ago?
I would say certainly in culture. You know, I know that that's something that, you know, it takes time sometimes, right, to build, you know, the foundations of that. And then, you know, in order for our student athletes to build a culture from year to year, they have to disseminate that information. And so if it's just coaches talking at people and saying, this is who we want to be for a year, because nobody else was with us at the start of it. Now there's people who have been in the program with us, you know, for a year now. And obviously thanking those guys that have been in our, you know, that were in our program last year that are no longer with us, obviously thankful to them for starting it. And then we have to, you know, put the onus on the guys in the locker room right now to continue to help the newcomers out and understanding who we are. When you're in that locker room, you're a Delaware Blue Hen. What does that mean? You know, what are our core values? What are our standards and our goals? How do we uphold and bring those core values to life with our daily actions? And then, you know, what do we play like? What is it like, you know, on the field with us? You know, how do we compete? And those are the things that I think that we did get deeper, you know, in. And I think, you know, our biggest charge here, you know, coming in and always is going to be, how do we continue to elevate the talent level in the building? And how do we continue to elevate bringing the bottom of our program up, right? Trying to have 100, we have 110 roster spots, trying to get 110 people that can play and help us play football games. And so I do think we've gotten deeper. I think our depth is pretty good right now. And again, that's a one of those knock on woods. And it's also one of the FCS football is tough. You know, you're a couple injuries away sometimes with the amount of scholarship players you have on your roster just based on equivalencies. You know, from probably eating those words too. And so, you know, I do think we've gotten faster and longer in the people that we've brought into the program, whether or not that translates, because we had a ton of guys with experience, guys that had played for years when we first showed up. And so I think we added to that. And then we lost a lot of those guys that had experience. So, you know, I do think there's talent there and we've replaced it. Whether or not we've replaced that that experience and that production, we'll find out, you know, in September and August 31st, we'll find out if that's going to translate. And then I think positionally, I would say the offensive line, running back position on offense. And then I think the defensive line, I think we got a little bit more depth there. I don't know that we have the, other than Chase McGowan, I don't know that we have the star level power there right now, but I'd like to think that there will be there.
I like it. Now that you have a year of tape, I know this like just helps with certain guys. I mean, like me being a Tennessee guy, like you have a year for Heupel now after that first year where you're like, this is what it looks like. It's fun. Like, we're not just saying this is actually what it's going to look like if you play here. Now that you have a year of tape, for your offense at Delaware, how has that changed how you recruit offensive skill position players?
Yeah, well, it does. And I think the good thing and what probably got Heupel to be able to recruit guys that first year also is what he's done in the past. You know, it helped us to say that, look, this is who we are, you know, and I brought most of my offensive staff from Sam Houston here. And you know, this is who we are. This is who we've been. And when my time in New Hampshire, my time at Sam Houston, we were always really good at this. And I think that does help because experience helps. But then seeing it in action and being able to point at, you know, these are the guys who were in this offense and set records. These were the guys who were in this offense and got signed by NFL teams. I think those things are certainly, you know, when you can point to the proof, it's a lot easier, you know, than saying, hey, this is going to happen. And we believe in this because, you know, we believe in this because the proof's there and because the, you know, when the talent's in an offense like this or a defense like this, you know, we're going to be able to put you in positions to make those plays. And, you know, how many, you know, it's easier to recruit skilled players when you can say, you know, we had six players last year with more than 20 catches, you know, and we got people the ball, and we had the ability to obviously put them in space, and then, you know, have the ability obviously after that to score points and win games. And I think that's the biggest thing in recruiting, is even less than the scheme and the accolades, is people want to play for winners. They want to be around winners. They want to be around championship level, you know, play. They want to be around championships. And so, you know, how do you convince somebody to come? Well, you keep winning. And I know it's chicken and the egg, but you know, if you win games, you're going to be able to recruit good players. And if you have the support staff around you and the coaches, assistant coaches around there that are still communicating the same messages to the student athletes and the prospective student athletes over the course of time, you know, it's going to only build and roll. You know, we can snowball into being as good as we want to be, which is the best team in FCS football.
How did playing quarterback for the Blue Hens set you up for success at Delaware now?
Well, you know, playing's a loose word.
You're playing. You're still, hey, practice counts. Every rep counts.
I think, honestly, if we're being honest, that probably set me up for success more than actually playing did. You know, being able to deal with, you know, setbacks and you know, disappointments and competition. You know, there was never a day that I wasn't out there competing for my life as a player, you know.
Yeah.
And I think those things help. And then, you know, being able to figure out ways that I thought I did well at competing and ways I didn't, things I thought I did well as being a leader, you know, being voted captain when I wasn't a starter was a pretty cool experience. And I think there, and I tell our guys now, I think there were certain things that I didn't do well, you know, because of it. I didn't know, it's a hard thing to do, and I probably could have done it better being a guy who wasn't on the field, but still tasked as being somebody who was supposed to help lead. And I think there were things that I learned from that, just like anything else, right? You almost learn from the things that don't go well a little bit more sometimes than the things you do do well. And so I think that certainly has helped. And then there's so many things that, and this is going to sound weird because it's probably not talked about in football podcasts much. There's a ton of things I learned as a business major here that have really helped me in my coaching career. In particular now, the more I had to start managing people and, you know, managing my time and using statistics and analytics and, you know, marketing and all that stuff that I learned in my time here as a student. I think really, it really does, you know, kind of translate into things that I'm going to have to deal with on a daily basis here as a head coach, because you're kind of a manager, you're kind of a CEO of this part of the athletic department. And those things have translated. And so it's been interesting to see that as well. So not just the stuff on the field or off the field, and it's been, you know, the stuff down campus as well that's really helped me in my time here.
What is the biggest lesson Chip Kelly taught you?
Coach Kel, and here's the thing I'm going to have to say. So I never worked with Coach Kel.
Yeah.
And I think the big things that I'll tell you a quick story, because I do remember this specifically happening, is, you know, we were playing at Delaware when I was at New Hampshire. And I don't know if it was the playoffs. So it was probably December, maybe late November. And it must have been one of those times when Coach Kel had a, you know, maybe there was a bye, you know, or in between a bowl game or something, and he flew in for the game. I was not the coordinator yet. So Tim Cramsey was the offensive coordinator. It was probably like 2010, 11 in that range, 10, based on who I'm thinking the quarterback was. And then, you know, Delaware had this best defense ever. They were unstoppable. They just played quarters almost every play, and then they're saying, just tracking us down, and it was tough. And so I want to say the halftime score wasn't great, maybe 7-0. I mean, we weren't moving the ball at all. And we had been that year. We were always pretty good on offense, and we stopped. And you know, at halftime I came back out and I saw Coach Kel on the sidelines, and I remember saying, Coach, what do you see? Like, anything you see that, you know, that could help us? And he said, you know, he's like, no, they're really good on defense, huh? And I was like, yeah. He's like, he said, hopefully, you know, you can throw the ball to T. Fox. He can make somebody miss and score a touchdown. And that was our one slot receiver, who was one of our all-conference player, good player. And I was thinking to myself, like, the time, whenever this was, I mean, I think Oregon was the number one offensive country at the time. And I'm, you know, he is known as the best offensive mind in the country. And he is, because I've talked ball with him. He's genius. And that was his thought. well, hopefully one of your best players can just go out there and make a score a touchdown tonight. And it really kind of reframed a lot of the things that I already kind of knew and I grew up learning from my father about, you know, space on a football field and putting people in advantageous situations in one-on-one matchups. But it really kind of, you know, poignantly put that, you know, matchup and good players and putting them in a position to be great players and make a difference in a game, it really put that in the forefront of my mind. And so I don't know if that's something that he taught me intentionally, but just one comment that he made kind of reframed a lot of the things that, you know, I use when I became a coordinator and it kind of, you know, all things that I kind of believed in already, but the fact that that was in that situation, something that, you know, really, you know, that somebody that I really respected thought, it kind of changed the way I thought about some things as well.
That's funny, because like I go to a lot of high school games and I'm just still into the high school. It's like the purest form of football. And I sometimes, because like I'm on the sidelines and just taking notes and seeing, okay, they're doing this, they're in base, okay, they're 11 personnel. I'm like, okay, this guy. And I'm just taking notes. And sometimes I'll be at the half or I'll walk by a coach I know and I'm like, oh, you're screwed. Like they're tied in. Like they know, because high school is just brutal now, because high school, like they're still matchup heavy in like in college and NFL, but high school, it's like, hey, if this guy can get targeted 23 times because you literally don't have the linebacker to stay with this tight end, we are going to throw it over his head over and over and over again. Why would we try and run anything else? We're not doing that. We don't need to do that. The whole point is to win games, and we're going to do that. It's brutal, but like what you're talking about, where you're like, your playmakers put in their hands, sometimes you literally don't have an answer. There's nothing you can do, and I'll just go, yep, that this one's over. I don't know what you're going to tell these kids in the half, because like you don't have another linebacker who can stay with this tight end. It just isn't going to happen.
Yep. Hope you can hang.
You hope you can hang. Not Delaware, though. You come from a family of coaches. And your dad, obviously a coach, your brother's coaching. You talked about like not necessarily being sure if you wanted to coach, is more the coordinator aspect type of thing, and calling plays being more your forte. Who's the most competitive of this bunch, and what's Thanksgiving and Christmas like? What do y'all just talk ball? Is there a rule from the wives and everything else where it's like, we are not talking football all time, like all day long, all night long? How does that work in your household?
Yeah, my poor mother. She grew up with us three boys only and my father, and everything eventually comes back to it, right? I mean, like by the end of the conversation, somebody's talking about football, and it's not intentional. Even when there is actual intent to not talk about it, it'll end up back.
Y'all are at Wicked on Broadway, and somehow you're like, this is actually like when they did this, it's kind of like when my slot receiver does this, and she's like, no, this can't happen.
There's no doubt. The most competitive, honestly, it's probably me.
Really?
Okay. And maybe it's that I grew up as the youngest and always was trying to get their attention, or my father's, or who knows, you know. I'm sure that was part of it. I would say my middle brother, Sean, also extremely competitive, but he's tamed out in his older age.
Okay.
And I'm probably that guy that's still wanting to turn everything into a competition, but
Are they sending you notes during games or after? Are you getting like the Sunday morning text thread of like, here's what we saw?
They're all coaches, so they know that that's not necessary. You know, like it'd be the family members that weren't coaches that would tell me what they thought. You know what
Interesting.
I mean?
And I'm sure you love that.
Coaches, they know that this is not the time to be talking about this. We're going to just sit here and say we support you. You know? Because he knows, they all know there's enough people telling me what they think that should be done. And so, it's great to have that support. The cool thing is that, you know, it's been a while since I've been this close to those, you know, all my family, really. They're all about a couple hours from us now. And so my dad gets a chance to spend a ton of time here and come to practices and be at every game. And my brothers, when they're not playing, get a chance to come down with my nieces and nephews and my sisters-in-law. And it's really fun to be back around this area. And yes, they have to put up with us when we're all talking ball, because it just ends up getting that way. Luckily, the in-laws all, you know, the three wives all get together and with my mom, and they actually do get along. So
there you go. That's it. That's imperative.
They talk with one room and everybody else is talking in the other room. And so
there you go. Final question. We'll wrap up here, Coach. Delaware, the food scene. What is your go-to spot? since being back in Delaware this year?
Oh, that's a great question. So there's a few places.
Okay.
Down on Main Street, we have, I mean, I want to say like 65, 70 places to eat on Main Street. Our Main Street's pretty impressive.
Mm.
There's a couple of good smaller spots. We got a place called Roots that does really good, you know, healthy bowls and that kind of stuff. The boys love El Diablo, which is a burrito joint down the road. If we're looking at like a higher end, you know, spot for Italian, we got Taverna and Cafe Gelato across the street from each other, both doing pretty awesome Italian. I would say, you know, if you're looking for, trust me, we're a food people around here. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for a good bagel, we got a place called The Original Hot Bagels, which is outstanding.
Okay. That sounds like a morning ritual for you. You lit up a little bit with the bagel. Bagel's good for you.
Big bagel people mm-hmm. in the Northeast, as you know.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's a place on campus called Klondike Kate's, which is actually a bar in the PM, but we do a lot of our recruiting meals there. It's kind of a staple at the one side of campus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, across the way here, if you want a good sandwich or cheesesteak, you got to go to a place called Malin's Deli, and it's they do a great job with their cheesesteaks and the Philly area food scene that we get. So I'm sure I missed one or two, but trust me, we love our food here. University of Delaware football staff is very in tune with the food scene on campus.
There you go. It's important.
A lot of our staff meetings are based around what the next meal looks like. So.
There you go. What's your guilty pleasure, food wise?
Food wise, I do love, you know, chocolate. You know, if we're gonna go sweets, it's gonna be milk chocolate.
Okay, I like it. Coffee? Are you a coffee guy to get through the day or no?
I do drink coffee. Yeah. Okay. Not a crazy amount, a couple a day. Nothing crazy.
Black or are we putting cream, almond milk? What are we doing?
Only black.
You get it, coach.
I'm an Americano guy, and it's just straight iced Americanos all day.
There you go. Now that's a Northeastern thing. That's too bitter for me. There's no way I'm doing that. I'm not doing ice Americanos. Really, there's really no strong. Way.
Really strong.
Yeah, that's strong. But hey, we're all built different, coach, and you're built different up there in Delaware. That's why you're the right guy for the Delaware Blue.
You gotta be, right?
You gotta be. Coach, thank you so much for the time. This has been a blast. Good luck this summer. And I'm excited to see what you guys got going on for year two here for Delaware football. And who knows, maybe Joe Flacco finally retires at some point and he's your offensive analyst, quarterback analyst in a couple of years.
Man.
Who knows?
He was here for a golf outing a couple of weeks ago and fit right back in.
There you go. That man, keep getting them checks, Joe Flacco. Hey, he's hanging around. He's doing the Brian Hoyer. He's just going to keep hanging around. You love it. Coach, thank you so much. Guys.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.